Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 409. I hope you are all well. Thank you for tuning in, guys. Today's guest is a fantastic one. It's the amazing Sophie Willen. She, as we discuss, had her pilot for a TV show that she wrote, created, starred in, Alma's Not Normal, come out the first week of the pandemic. Get commissioned for a series the second week of the pandemic, and then however further on, she won a BAFTA for it. But she's got a fantastic story, and I really wanted to sit down. I'm really enjoying the series. As you listen to this, it's out now on BBC iPlayer, with episodes airing Mondays on BBC Two at 10 p.m. It's called Alma's Not Normal. But it's also, as I said, there's loads of other stuff that we wanted to talk about, so I was delighted to get Sophie on. We had a few technical issues with the Zoom, but that all got smoothed out. And I'd imagine Buddy Peace is the best producer in the world, so you probably won't even notice that. But I thought I'd warn you of it. Oh, and also, how am I sounding, man? I've got new gear for the first time in the seven or so years I've been doing this podcast. After asking you guys online for recommendations, I got the Shure MV7 USB and XLR mic, because that was one that you guys, I tweeted about it and you guys were raving about that, and I'm feeling it, man. I think it sounds good. I hope you think it sounds good. I probably need to get used to the levels and find where I need to be, but yeah, I hope you like it. Anyway, before we get into this, I mean two people that we mentioned on this, in fact a few people we mentioned on this podcast that are previous guests, if you want to go and check their episodes out. We mentioned Jade Adams, we mentioned Gus Kahn, we mentioned Tez Ilyas, we mentioned Rob Parker. All of those are previous guests. We mentioned Michaela Cole, we mentioned Daisy Haggard, we mentioned Ashlyn B. We mentioned a lot of people who are previous guests, so you might want to go and check them out. We mentioned the People Just Do Nothing lot. So yeah, everyone we mentioned I've had on before, so it's worth digging into the back catalogue. Those episodes and this episode are brought to you by speechdevelopmentrecords.com. That's my label and my web store. There's podcast merch, there's my music merch, my spoken word merch, there's DVDs, there's all sorts. Head over there if you want to support the podcast or just want to look good in this summer/autumn/winter. We got you covered. And you can also head over to patreon.com/ScroobiusPip to get on the Patreon crew. I think we're lining up a Zoom hangout soon with the Patreon lot, so that'll be happening. Check that out. Yeah, let's get on with the podcast. This is episode 409 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with Sophie Willen. Right, I'm here today with Sophie Willen. How are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I'm good. How was your grapefruit juice this morning?
It was fabulous. You saw that I was showing off because I made my own grapefruit juice. Yeah, I got up, I juiced three grapefruits this morning.
That was impressive. What a start to the day, right?
Well, that's what I thought, because I had lots of interviews today. I thought, you know, to do them justice, I should juice a few grapefruits, wax some ice in, put it in a jug.
Look at that.
Finish the jug.
Do you think all this TV industry has changed you? Would you have been juicing a few grapefruits a few years back and whacking them in an icy jug, or, you know?
Well, do you know, I've always loved a grapefruit, to be honest. It's my favourite fruit.
Fair.
My grandma used to have them every morning. She'd have half a grapefruit, but then she'd put a shitload of sugar on top of it.
Yeah.
And then put it in the fridge and it'd go hard.
Brilliant.
For the night. Yeah, it's like icing.
Yeah.
So she was kind of half healthy. She had a good intention.
Yeah.
She had a fried Spam sandwich and a grapefruit covered in sugar. So it's kind of...
Yeah, a bowl full of sugar helps the grapefruit go down.
Yeah, exactly.
I love it.
Yeah.
So how are you in general? How have you been? It's been obviously a weird year for everyone, but you've had the juxtaposition of amazing career success alongside a global pandemic, you know.
It's been mad, really, yeah.
Winning a BAFTA, from the pilot, getting a TV show, making the TV show, all of this amazing stuff. But also, the world's kind of breaking. So how's that been as an ups and down juxtaposition?
Yeah, quite a weird dichotomy, isn't it, really? Because, yeah, I mean, there's a bit of you thinking, you know, what's the point sometimes?
Yeah.
You make a show, but actually, you know, who knows if we'll survive this next year? But then as we're coming out of it, there's a bit more optimism, isn't there?
Yeah.
I think being able to go to the shop again, sit in a pub, you do feel a bit more optimistic, don't you? There was a kind of good positive for me, though, in the fact that I could actually write for a year without any distractions. It was basically like being in a writing cave for a year, you know, so in that way it's quite positive.
That's a blessing, right? Because particularly with TV, there can often be a lot of pressure and deadlines and rushing. And I think where, at least at the start of the pandemic, no one knew what was happening, I think it might have, it took the pressure off a lot of people who otherwise might have had a bit more. We need this now, you know, we need to get moving.
And there was no work, was there? So it's kind of helpful.
Yeah.
You know, if nobody's working, you don't feel you should be, or there was nothing coming in other than writing this sitcom. So in that way, it was really helpful.
Yeah.
It was a very tricky time for everybody, very unstable time, you know, with work and especially the comedy industry, so much of it's live and everything's shutting down. So, you know, wanting to celebrate but not rub it in. There's a fine line,
really,
isn't there? It's like this morning when I was juicing that grapefruit and putting it on the internet. Am I celebrating? Am I showing off?
It's a fine balance. Well, there's loads I want to talk about. I want to talk you about your route into comedy. I want to talk all about Hours Not Normal because I'm loving it. I want to talk about the importance of diversifying an industry that's a lot of middle-class people who went to private schools. I want to talk about everything, essentially. But I want to start by discussing the fact that I think The Circle is the best reality TV show ever. And you were the voice of The Circle. It's great, isn't it? It was so weird how I watched the first season purely by chance. I was sitting for my mum and her Sky wasn't working. So I only had five channels. I slung it on and I became addicted. It's wonderful, isn't it? Because it's reality TV that's not being horrible. As simple as that sounds.
Yeah, it's really,
it's just
good
really
fun.
Nice and lovely. And they seem to get quite nice people rather than looking for who's going to be, a villain.
Yeah. Yeah, I loved it. It's a shame they're not bringing back the UK version, unfortunately.
I couldn't believe it because this last one was the best. Yeah, I was fully on the Manrika train and hoping her and Uncle Saeed, all of it. I mean, I won't get too in deep because there's a lot of people who probably isn't going to have a clue, but it's great, isn't it? How was that to do the voiceover for, and how is that kind of voiceover work? It's obviously a different skill and area, right?
It's a different skill and area, but again, it's still kind of comedy in a way. You know, you're commentating, you're making jokes, you're having a laugh. So it was really good fun. I worked with a writer, Lee Gant, who's also brilliant. We had a real laugh. You're in this space together for hours and hours and hours. I mean, it's like you get there in the morning or whatever, and then you're there till like 10 p.m. at night, and it's just me and Lee in a room together for hours. By the end, you know, we'd gone delirious, the pair of us. I remember one night, I think I was yodeling, and he was pretending to do like a fake air trumpet, and I just looked at him and said, "We've gone mad. We've got to get out." But you become very close to people. He's very mellow and I'm not so mellow. So he had to adapt to my energies. You know, we had a lot of a laugh.
It's got to be the perfect combination for that kind of thing then.
Yeah, it was quite fun.
Because with voiceover stuff, you don't want it to be too static and relaxed. But then obviously you possibly don't want it to be absolutely bonkers. So that combination of the mellow and the not so mellow must be a lot of fun.
It was fun just kind of getting to know each other and just accepting each other's very opposite personalities. Like when I came in, because he'd been on the US version before me, and he'd just been very comfortable, or not comfortable, but just miserable, sat on a table and a really, with a little table and a really uncomfortable chair, plastic chair. And he'd been there for 6 weeks in this massive, sparse room. Anyway, I got there, I said, "Oh, this is horrible. It's dead depressing." And I found a storage cupboard that they had with all the bits that they'd not used for the flats. And I just kitted out our room. I had plants. I had different lightings. He had his own reading chair with a light so he could relax into it. So I really helped him embrace his inner diva, I think. I probably created a monster. He's on the American show now, so I'm sure he's got a very intense rider with a chaise longue.
I mean,
you know.
Speaking of, and I need to come on to this immediately now, because speaking of opposites and embracing inner diva, the wonderful burgeoning friendship of you and Jade Adams is a joy. And Jade was saying that you two were at Mighty Hoopla at the beginning of the week, and it was a sight to behold. Do you enjoy getting to embrace the outer diva rather than the inner diva and just go all out at events or festivals or whatever else?
Well, it was really fun at this one because me and Jade accidentally packed the same outfit. We had a lilac two-piece suit, and then I had a lilac crop vest and a yellow jacket. She had a yellow crop dress and a lilac jacket. I'll send you the pictures.
I love it.
Bizarre.
It's not like we happened to pack the same thing and it was like a black dress or something standard. This is quite, you know, they're bold choices anyway.
I mean, bright lilac. Lilac and yellow. Who'd have thought? Very good combo. So, yeah, that was very good fun. We had a really good laugh, actually. So it's nice. It's nice after Alma to celebrate, you know, with everybody, really. And the other cast members, you know, it's been lovely celebrating with them, James and Katie, catching up with them when I can and stuff. So it's been fabulous, yeah.
I love it. Well, I mean, I've seen loads of people asking if Alma is based on real life or not. And basically, some of it is, some of it isn't. So let's move on from that boring question. But can I just...
Yeah, thanks.
But can I just kind of find out about what your upbringing was like a little bit? Because you grew up in Bolton, right? Yeah. And what I love about Alma's Not Normal, even about, I think a lot of the things the BBC are doing, you know, about people just do nothing, kind of about this country, is they're looking at characters and areas and themes that would often be demonised or looked down upon or sniggered at in other TV throughout history. But you're not laughing at them. You're just showing them and going, no, look, these are these people. They're not, they're weird. Like, there's some weird characters in here, but we're not putting them on screen to go, oh, look at these.
Punching below, isn't it? And I think you can always tell when you see something that's punching below and it feels disconnected. These people don't know these people. They've seen them from a distance and they're trying to laugh at them or tell their story. It always feels awful. When it's people you know and you've lived with and it's your story and it's their story, you're always coming with love and empathy, aren't you, which has to be at the root of it, really, I think.
And that comes across, yeah.
Yeah, well, for me, you know, a lot of it obviously is drawn from my experiences, but the telling my story started, well, really, in when Cameron got into government, to be honest. Like, the whole time, I just felt furious all the time because the demonising of people like my mum, who, you know, has addiction problems and she's been homeless and she's been a streetwalker. She's had a lot of stuff and I've been a care leaver, so I've been in and out of the care system and all the class stuff and the welfare state, all of that demonising. My mum lost her council house and she lost her benefits because she was deemed fit for work, even though she wasn't. She lost her district nurse because they cut them. She lost the local clinic where you could go and get your injections and stuff. That got shut down. So she was expected to get on two buses to get her injection. You know, and then she declined, having been, you know, clean for like six, 7 years. It all just completely fell down.
And understandably, when that many rugs are pulled from under your feet, it's not surprising that you fall over. You know, there's...
Yeah, and you've been housed next to four drug dealers because that's the housing area that they've put you in and your medication's not accessible. So, and then, you know, I was turning on the telly and watching, like, Loose Women, you know, annihilate Josie Cunningham and just thinking it was just so upside down. I just felt furious watching Gary Barlow be the voice of the people when he's avoiding his taxes. Yeah. The whole thing, I felt very angry, which I think is a great place to write comedy from, actually. Not bitterness, but anger, which I think is a really loving emotion. Felt anger and a lot of love for my mum and a lot of love for my family. And I wanted to kind of give an antidote, really, to all of that and explore people similar in Alma that often get, you know, people are frightened, you know, of people like that. They hear a certain image from the media, from the world. They might see somebody on a tram like my mum or like Lynn, and they freeze up immediately, like there's going to be a problem. So I think for me, I've felt since I did my first show about it in 2016, I just wanted to show the full full human beings, really.
Yeah, and I think you do that amazingly in the show. And one line I made a note of, because there's a story going throughout about Alma deciding whether or not she wants to become a full-service sex worker. And she goes towards it and then goes away from it, which, again, I loved that, that it wasn't a straight, oh, let's try this. Mm. The fact that she went to try it and then said, oh, no, this isn't for me. I'm not going to give too many spoilers because that, you know, that varies along the show. But I think it's in episode 2 or 3, there's a line which I've made this argument so many times online because my partner is in the sex work industry, not full service, online stuff and things like that. And again, it's so weird that that industry, and the line you put, I've roughly noted it, was, why do we psychoanalyze sex workers and ask how empowered they are? We don't do it for any other job. Is Sue on the phones at telesales, in the telesales office, empowered?
Yeah.
And again, we do that all the time with that jobs. What's their mental health history? What's their, are they happy? Do they love their job?
Yeah.
I've had millions of jobs I don't love. I've had some jobs I do love, yet it's this, because of the taboo over sex work. And again, I really like how you drift from character to character, referring to it as prostitution, to referring to it as sex work, because there are terms that, again, in the era of Cameron, when they were demonising a lot of these things, prostitute or hooker or whatever else became attacking language, yet they also became just part of our language. So people who don't know it's insulting will just use them. So I really like that even Alma kind of seems to learn along the way of, all right, I'm going to refer to it as sex work or full service sex work or whatever else, rather than I want to be a prostitute and so on and so forth. So how was all that to get into and write about?
I think for me it was really important because, like you say, everybody wants to psychoanalyse and everybody's got a really set opinion about sex work and what they think about it as a feminist issue, and, you know, they politicise it. It gets so politicised when actually it shouldn't be so politicised. And what I wanted to do was, rather than try and tell anybody what they should think and feel about it, is just present all the sides of the discussion, really, and with nuance, you know.
Yeah. One of the things I loved about your writing in Alma's Not Normal is the fact that your character and Jade's character argue a bit and go back and forth. And it's so common, and that's a really good way to get discussions and complex subjects across. I think Michaela Cole did it flawlessly in I May Destroy You, the kind of the falling out and the back and forth between the good friends. How important was that to get across that this isn't a simple subject? Have conflict between good characters. Neither of your two characters are bad, are the bad guys. So to have conflict and difference of opinions allows the viewer, I guess, to watch and not feel like they're being preached at or told that they're wrong for thinking this or wrong for being curious or whatever else.
Yeah, I think it was really important for me that. I think, again, about the escorting, wanting to present all sides of the debate. Yes, it's empowering. Yes, it can be disempowering. And just present it very fully with nuance rather than there being these very tribal, divisive ideas about what sex work is. And actually, through Leanne and Alm, it felt like a really good way to have that debate and discussion, because ultimately these two people love each other. And I think that's often lost as well when we're having all these debates all the time on the internet or whatever. Actually, if you just connect with the other side of the story, you know, that felt important. And it's also lovely for friends to have a big row, I think, because especially for Jade's character, for Leanne, you know, we've talked at length, you know, as Jade refers to herself as a fat person, which is the term she says to use. And she said, you know, actually for her, the way she'll get put on telly is interesting. So when I was writing Alma, I wanted to speak to her about, you know, sexuality, for example, different things. And when I was writing Leanne, I didn't want her to be the fat, fun friend. You know, I wanted to give her layers. You know, she's a sexual, sensual person and her sexuality is not a joke. She can be a bit of a dick sometimes. She can be full of love. She can be a little bit judgmental. You know, so I wanted her to have more layers as well. And their friendship to be more complicated than just, oh, look at these two, you know.
I love that. And I think that level of nuance comes largely from giving a voice to working class writers, because anyone from a working class family, you know, if you're in comedy, if you're in entertainment, if you're in the arts, you're probably going to be reasonably left-leaning. If you come from a working class background, you're going to have either gone to school with people or have people in your family who are leaning in the complete opposite direction. And those are people who can be won over or educated to a kind of more liberal way of thinking or a more positive, less harmful way of thinking, I guess. But that comes from discussion and interaction and debate. It doesn't come from chastising and having a go at someone or cutting them off, you know. And I think that comes across here and feels natural here in a way it maybe wouldn't have when we were getting so many series from, as I said at the start, middle class, private school educated voices.
Yeah, because I think there seems to be a lack of empathy from people outside their own experience, you know. So I think that's the thing, isn't it? And I do think when you've come from, you know, varied or difficult or working class backgrounds, you've met so many different types of people. You've rubbed along together. You've not rubbed along well together. You know, there's a bit more kind of forgiveness, I think, and more understanding for other humans. Yeah.
Yeah, I completely agree. So kind of, I guess, speaking of different background stuff, what was your route into comedy? Because you've spoken about how you've come through the care system. You've had various different periods of your life and different varied experiences. Most of them aren't ones that necessarily traditionally lend you to think, oh, you'll definitely have a career in entertainment or in the arts. I know growing up in the part of Essex I've lived my whole life, the idea of being in entertainment was never discussed. It was never an option. It was never on the table. So what was your route to kind of going, no, here's what I want to do?
I think that was my grandma, really, because she just really encouraged me. She was one of my foster parents.
Yeah.
She took me to Ibiza because she loved clubbing. She'd just got divorced and she'd got really into Café Del Mar and all that stuff.
Amazing.
So she went off clubbing and I joined the Hotel Drama Club, and that's when I got the bug. Loved it. I performed the crying clown and grandma was at the back of the room with a cigarette and a large vodka, and she just said, you've got it. She said, hey, Marilyn Monroe was an orphan, you could be the next Marilyn. So she's quite blunt like that.
Amazing.
And then when we got back, you know, she bought me Alan Bennett the book because she loved Alan Bennett Talking Heads.
Yeah.
She introduced me to Mike Lee films before that, I think, as well, which was always with grandma trying to help me understand my experiences, you know, trying to help me understand that it's okay. You know, I remember watching Secrets and Lies about the girl who's adopted. She meets Brenda Blethyn. And, you know, you're just finding all these stories that kind of give you some comfort in a way. Grandma loved Shirley Valentine, so I could recite the whole of Shirley Valentine by the time I was 9 years old. It's one of my favourite films. So I think, you know, I was always around kind of these complex characters on screen and loved them. You know, John Waters, Hairspray, Tracy Turnblatt, you know, the characters that were just outside of what was considered normal or people that had been through things. Again, it's a working class story, isn't it, Hairspray, that working class girl. So, you know, grandma was brilliant in helping me see these people that I could relate to. And just
I was gonna say exactly that. It's the relating to, and it's why representation is so damn important in this time, in this era that we're going through of changing who is necessarily the default on screen. Because everyone you've listed there, they will have clicked with you because they're northern and working class. Yeah. And you can go, oh, right, that could be me, rather than, oh, this is amazing to look at, but it's clearly so far out of reach. And everyone, like, you've given an amazing list there, but they will have been at that time one or two films a year that were having that kind of representation. Thankfully, you had a grandma or a nan who had almost put together curated that collection for you to go, here's what you've missed, here's what you can watch and be inspired by. I love it.
Yeah. Well, she was very interesting because she'd got divorced and she was having this whole renaissance, very much like Joan, and she got really into films. And she, you know, in some ways she was quite, you know, not always... her parenting style was both brilliant and dreadful, if I'm quite honest with you. Yeah. I mean, she was mad as a badger.
Yeah.
So it was intense, you know. But on the other side, she was fabulous. I mean, I remember sitting watching Thelma and Louise with her yeah. when I was about 8 years old, and she'd be sitting there with a vodka and a cigarette going, this is power, you know. She was quite an intense woman, but she was original and ahead of her time. So I think, you know, you're having these people in your life who inspire you, you know. She took a picture, she had a, found a picture of the first black female barrister, pinned it on the kitchen wall, and she said, remember, wow. you can do anything. So she was very ahead of her time like that. For Bolton as well.
Yeah.
She was friends with different races. She was friends with gay men. You know, she was talked about feminism in the cricket club. It did not go down well. She yeah. wore a zebra print onesie whilst talking about feminism. So she just didn't really care or play by the rules. And I think that had a big influence. And she kind of said, you can do anything. So for that, I'm very grateful to her, really.
Yeah, so inspirational. So one of the early themes in Alma's is her reluctance to get a normal job, I guess. Was that a similar thing for you? At that early age, you got the bug. But again, coming from working class backgrounds, you're normally going to have to do something else for a period of time to put food on the table.
I did loads of crap jobs, yeah. mate. Loads. I remember at one point I worked three jobs. I used to work in a news agency with a woman who had insomnia, so she'd get you to get there really early in the morning. I worked in a bookies and I was so bad at the job. Yeah. It was a telephone bookies. I was very bad. I kept getting confused with the phones.
Yeah.
And then I worked at Subway.
Yeah.
And I had a job at TK Maxx as well that same time.
Nice.
So I moonlighting loads of jobs. I had loads of waitressing jobs. I was always storming out, could never get on with chefs. Weirdly, my grandma, she's done loads of jobs. Like she was a cleaner, she worked for Ann Summers. She'd done loads of waitressing jobs and she's always got into fights with chefs. I threw a grapefruit at a chef once. And I found out from my grandma, she'd actually thrown a melon at a chef's head. So I
amazing. That's why you've yeah. got a connection with grapefruit juice. Is it's been a
Maybe
it's been
it.
A,
yeah.
a saviour in the past. I think it can be yeah. really important for character to work a variety yeah. of jobs. But I also think it's really important quite early on to quit a job.
Yeah.
To know your worth, to walk out on something. And that sounds kind of counterintuitive or the opposite of what we're taught. But I think it can be really important to go, you know what? You're not treating me well enough and I deserve better.
Yeah.
And I think that can really help, particularly in the entertainment industry, where you can be very much pushed to feel that you're in a queue and there's someone waiting
yeah.
directly behind you to take your place. So, yeah, that's great to hear of those moments of kind of working
yeah,
hard.
Feeling.
But then also going, you know what? Fuck off. This is rubbish.
yeah.
I'm not doing
and the
this.
Feeling that you should be grateful, I think, in this industry
yeah.
as well is silliness, isn't it? It's that actually you're bringing a lot to the table,
yeah.
you know, and they should be grateful to have you as well. I mean, it's that thing, isn't it, I think, of getting over that because that could, and the imposter syndrome that comes with class is a big one, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one because I think my experience of that when I was doing music was years later looking back at Glastonbury. And Glastonbury, I've had some of my best gigs in the world there, or in my life there, sorry. But they've never paid very well. And the bulk of them, you've had to do for free because they trade off the fact, the honour of playing at Glastonbury.
Yeah, the
honour. I get that, but Glastonbury without the artists is
yeah.
a field. Is a
Absolutely.
Field with some cows. And I think there's a similar thing with The Fringe at time. The Fringe is one of my favourite places to be. But
yeah.
the pressure to be up there and to be losing money and to be miserable and to be not having any days off because
yeah.
you need to be there because otherwise someone else will take your slot and it's an honour to be up there. It's a mad one, right? I worked with Gus Kahn on a film a while back and me and Gus proper connected and we talked a lot about real people and how important it is to meet real people. And Gus always did his comedy in the Midlands. He never fucked with the Fringe. He never fucked with the big London circuit.
Good for him, yeah.
And when I was chatting to you at one point, or chatting to Jade about you at one point, she literally said, Sophie's the realest person I've met. And it instantly made me think, right, that's where me and Gus connected. That was us going,
yeah.
all right, I believe this. I believe
yeah.
the conversations we're having. And therefore, I want you to go to the absolute moon with it. So
yeah.
I guess how important is that, finding those real people in such a, in an industry where our job is to not be real, if you know what I mean, work-wise.
Definitely. Telly-wise,
it's lie.
Telly's not real, is it? It's like this weird bubble.
Yeah.
And that's why I think when people get too stuck in that weird bubble, they can't write either, because they can't write. They're disconnected from the rest of the world and the rest of the people in the country.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, you know, you've got an industry that's full of privately educated people. They're a different ilk of people. There's nothing wrong with them, but they've been trained, conditioned in a completely different way to the rest of the country, the way they interact. You know, they're in a situation where they have to go to these schools and do social warfare, really, don't they? They have to get status. They have to say the right thing at the right time in the right room. You know, I noticed it when I went to Melbourne Comedy Festival, and so many of them had gone to private school. I thought that the way, it fascinated me the way they communicated. Everything was kind of very calculated and considered, and, you know, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it seems quite knackering to me. I don't know how they keep it up. It does seem exhausting.
Yeah, completely. So I mean, in which case, it comes on nicely to something I want to talk about. Something I think is great about what you've done with Almas is you've got this opportunity, and it's a big break, but in my opinion it's the first step of a long journey in your career, but straight off the bat you've gone, I want to be aware of who I'm employing, of who I'm giving roles to, behind the scenes and in front of the camera, and I want to talk about both. And it made me wonder if any of that came from working on the Tez O'Clock show, because I remember talking to Tez when he got that opportunity, and he was like, I want Northern working class comedians on this show, because I've been given this opportunity. I'm from Blackburn. I want to represent that. So was that an influence there, or was that just something that was already in your mind that when I get through the door, I'm fucking holding it open, you know?
No, not an influence, but I think me and Tez have always had a shared passion in that area, which is why we're friends.
Yeah.
But yeah, for me, it was just always what I had to do. I mean, when I've done my live stand-up shows, I've always put in an Arts Council bid and made sure that at least 10%, usually 20% of the tickets in the big venues and in all the small venues as well, go out to either care experienced people, people of low-income families, women with addiction and mental health and housing issues, get free tickets to the show.
Amazing.
Deliver workshops in every town that I've done when I've done shows, you know. So then for me, I've set up my own charity for care experienced people who want to get into the arts. So for me, it felt like there's no way I could...
Stories for Care? Or Stories of Care?
Stories of Care, yeah. So it just felt for me that if I was to do a sitcom, there'd be no way that it would not include, you know, behind the scenes, it should be, you know, we should be paying people and training them up so that they can get into telly from the inside and change the game that way. And as far as on screen, I mean, for me, I've just felt there's no way it couldn't be a show that's representative where I come from. And also not just where I come from, like having Jade on it, you know, having unusual, fearless women on screen that are all different, you know, because I find it frustrating sometimes you turn on the telly and the representation of women, and no offence because a lot of them are fabulous, but they're all the same, polite, harmless, middle-class women that are quite quick-witted, smiley and lovely. But you'll have three of them. And I always think, God, come on, take some risks.
Yeah.
You know, be a bit bolder. And so I wanted to be extremely bold and have four very intense women on your screen all at once and see how people digest it.
Yeah.
The reality is they digest it fine because it's just like their family's back home.
Yeah.
But I think what happens in telly is because they all went to private school who commission it, they do like to go, well, I feel comfortable with them lot. And they'll commission women that they feel comfortable with to see on the screens. You know, they don't feel it's a bit of a threat. I think there's people like me and Jade and Siobhan and Lorraine that have got a kind of intensity to us and a harshness and a big in-your-faceness that can be often a bit off-putting to commissioners or to people.
I was going to say specifically to commissioners, and because, again, it goes back to that familiarity. The reason all of those people that your nan showed you inspired you was because you could relate. The reason these commissioners are panicking is because they can't relate in this situation. But that's why it's important. That's why it's meant to be spread out. And again, it's mad to it's mad that I'm sitting here thinking how inspiring and powerful it is that you've made a point of putting people from a similar background in these positions and giving them opportunities when the middle classes and the private school educated people have been doing that from day one.
Yeah, the nepotism.
They've been putting people from their background in the roles, in the opportunities, opening the door for them. Mm. So why should it be a surprise when the working classes do exactly the same? It should be. It should be a natural thing. It should be a given, right?
Yeah. And also I wanted to prove that, you know, people like me and Jade, who are often told, oh, there's one of you already, sort of thing, we can both be on the screen at the same time.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to steal each other's glory. You can support each other, both shine and be fabulous. There's no reason why we have to be in direct competition with all these brilliant, powerful, strong female actors.
Yeah.
You know, so that for me was important, you know.
Yeah, completely. And as you say, you've got four actors, female actors and characters there that are all huge. They're big and they're bold and they're risk-taking type characters. And it's not overwhelming and it's not too much. And it's not, it doesn't overload your senses. It's fine. It just needed to be allowed to happen, you know, rather than all the excuses that on paper, this might feel a bit much. Like, put it on screen, it's not. And sure enough.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
It.
I feel really chuffed with that. And I'm chuffed it worked, because you never know, do you? So, pleased.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to bring someone up that probably won't have been brought up in any other interviews you've done about this, because it's one you cast one of my favorite people in the world in episode 4, I think it was. He's an actor called Rob Parker, and he played the policeman in a flashback. And I think Rob is absolutely amazing, and I think he could be an absolute superstar. He's acting part-time because he's got to put food on the table, he's got a family to feed, but I've never met anyone who is so natural and relaxed and comfortable on screen.
And he's from Bolton,
isn't from Bolton. I visited him a couple of days ago, or a week or so ago, before we lined this up, in fact. He's just moved to Preston. He's having a lovely time.
He was fabulous. Yeah, he was brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to say, how important was that to give opportunities to people who aren't like a big name or got huge agents or whatever else, but are just good and are real and a proper.
Really important, because again, it's about, you know, thinking in a few different ways. Practically speaking, you want the sitcom to feel real.
Yeah.
And represent the place. So when people watch it, they go, we know that feels real.
Yeah.
And then on a personal level, it's just like, as an actress from Bolton, often thinking, how'd you get in? How'd you get in?
Yeah.
They had a theatre in Bolton called The Octagon.
Right.
It's a bit better now, but there was an old artistic director there, and he put the play on Love on the Dole. And I went to watch it, and I went to the Q&A afterwards. None of the actors, it's a northern working class socialist play, none of the actors were from the north of England. They were all from London.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it.
It's mad, isn't it?
So, I know, so I think for me, on a personal level, there's just no way I could feel comfortable to do that as well. And it makes it so much better. I mean, Dave, who plays Bill as well, Jade Adams' boss, he is brilliant. He did an open audition as well. We did two lots of open auditions for the pilot and then again for the series. He did the open audition for the pilot. He was brilliant. You know, we've added lines in for him. I wrote him bigger because he was so great. And that strong Bolton accent, it is very funny.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been great. There's been Brian, who's in the acting class, who does the bad Scottish accent.
Yeah.
He was an open casting. He's never acted before in his life.
Oh,
he did it on his phone with his brother, was doing it in lockdown, the audition. You know, so I think it's just fabulous, isn't it? I think it feels really positive. It could, you know, lead on to loads of new acting opportunities for them. And for me, it makes the show fantastic and gives it that authenticity, doesn't it?
I completely agree. And that rings true and rings through the screen. But speaking of the pilot, again, as someone who follows your friend Jade Adams online, I was very aware when you won a BAFTA because of a video that she shared that went absolutely viral and went absolutely loony. Can you talk anyone who hasn't seen it through that? What was the situation and where were you and how that all played out?
So I was filming Alma in Bolton, and they put me up in a barn, a lovely converted barn. It was gorgeous, so that we could stay there, because I was in lockdown for 6 weeks. Yeah. I had to be on set and then go home.
Yeah.
And I thought, if I'm stuck in my little flat with no outdoor space in Manchester, I'll go mad. I said to the producer, I need to see a tree in the morning just so I don't go crazy. Yeah. So anyway, they put me in this barn. It's beautiful. And it was like shared barns with other people on the farm. Anyway, we're watching the announcement. I didn't realise Jade was filming it, but she's quite savvy, isn't she, with the social media?
Is,
so she's a bit sneaky, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've noticed she films you when you don't realise. I was complaining at a bar about the prices. Next thing I know, it's a story on Instagram. You get to watch her, actually.
Love her.
Anyway, she filming it. We've kind of turned away. We thought, oh, it's lovely, little, you know, nomination, whatever, but wasn't expecting it. Turned away, and then it said my name. I couldn't believe it. So I ran round the whole barn. I was wearing a sequin dress and stilettos, screaming, what the F, what the F. Woke all the neighbours' kids up that just been put to bed. Had to go and greet them, hug them, screamed at a tractor.
Yeah.
It was wild, really.
I love the excited apologies and thinking it's going to make any sense that your explanation is I've just won a BAFTA. I was thinking half of them are going to go, I don't know what's going on here. This is too much to take in, but it was a joy.
I think it was pretty mad. Yeah, for them, they were just like, what's going on, you know?
Yeah.
It was fabulous. It was a fabulous day. And then going straight on set the next day.
Amazing.
What a roller coaster.
Did it change the feeling on set at all? Did it make you even more aware that you're getting to do something exciting here? Or was it already just, oh my God, you know, we're making my show?
I think it gave everybody a bit of a pick-me-up because we were in the final 2 weeks of filming and we were all knackered. With the COVID restrictions, it makes filming so much more difficult.
Of course.
My grandma had passed away on the second day of filming.
Mate, that's horrible to hear. I'm so sorry.
And she was in the kind of, you know, obviously it's inspired by Grandma Joan. So I was kind of every day acting these scenes that were kind of slightly inspired by my grandma whilst she just passed away. So it was a real roller coaster. She died on the second day of filming at 9 p.m. I woke up the next morning, got in my makeup show, and they said, oh, you've been nominated for a BAFTA. So it was just a roller coaster of emotions, you know. I had to go and tell my mum about her mother being dead. You're going through all those different things. I went to Grandma's funeral, which was actually fabulous, but we all wore leopard print. And,
love it.
We carried out the coffin to I'm Too Sexy For My Shirt, because she loved her.
Beautiful.
So, but it's like it was a rainbow of events. So by the time I won the BAFTA, it was that last oomph that we all needed to kind of just give welly to the last 2 weeks, you know.
The best of us, this past year or two feels like it's been a weird dream. That must be next level for you, from absolute joy to absolute heartache. It must be, are you getting any time to sit back and go, look what I've done, like look what I've achieved in this period?
Well, I've not really had any time off because we went straight from writing to pre-production, straight to filming, then straight into the edit, and then literally I finished it. They said, we're going to go straight to pilot, to Earth, obviously on Monday. So it was a 3-week window I've had.
Yeah.
But we did go to Mighty Hoopla and I did take a few days, just Saturday, Sunday and Monday, just enjoy. I had Saturday, Sunday at Hoopla. Then the Guardian feature came out and at first I was a bit freaked out with such a big feature and I was like, oh God, it's happening. And then I just thought, you know what, I'm just going to enjoy myself and celebrate.
Yeah.
And just take a minute to savour these moments, you know, it's important. So I went to Shoreditch House, had a glass of champagne and just took a moment to kind of, you know, be grateful and enjoy the journey. I think is so important when it's such a whirlwind, isn't it?
Yeah, again, for some reason, it's only just clicked that was the Shoreditch House rooftop pool in Jade's story of you both enjoying features. It's a hell of a time.
It was quite a lovely morning because she had a feature, I had one.
Yeah.
Jade's very good at going, come on, let's diva it up, which I really do appreciate because sometimes it's good to have someone embrace that and go, I'm celebrating me today. You know, so it's quite positive.
Completely. Again, I think it's such a working class thing to go, to not want to make a deal of anything or not want to brag or show
off.
But
if you've,
worked bloody hard, then you deserve a moment or two, you know. And I think also when you're, you know, writer and you're so involved, You can get caught up in the industry. You can get caught up in the when's it airing, how do reviews looking, what are the viewing figures going to be, are we getting another series, this, that and that, what's next? And you don't get a moment to go, mate, as I said, look what we've done. Look what we've achieved
life is
here.
Fabulous.
And what a tribute to your nan, you know. What a beautiful thing to be able to go, look, I've immortalised you. Yeah.
Well, she got to see the pilot before she died and she did love it. So that was
that's
wonderful
amazing.
Because she was, she was just having this funny time just before she died, just going, oh, God, what have I achieved? Who am I? Oh, God. It was quite a weird time for her. Then the pilot came out. She just went, I'm so pleased with every rebellious decision I've ever made. You know? And she loved it. So that felt fabulous. And I've got the soundtrack for her because she loved all the songs.
Yeah.
And we played that quite a bit, you know. So it had a really positive impact on her, I think, as well. So
beautiful. Well, before I start to wrap things up, I've realised that we've just jumped into talking about this because I'm excited and I've been watching it all recently. I should mention that as this comes out, because this is coming out next Wednesday, all episodes will be on iPlayer and episodes will be airing Mondays on BBC Two at 10 p.m. But do you want to just quickly tell people what Alma's Not Normal is? Because I realise we've not really done that. We've talked about a lot of the subjects and topics, but we've not really given a rough kind of elevator pitch of here's what the show is.
Yeah, so Alma's Not Normal is a sitcom of six episodes where you follow Alma, who's a Boltonian wild child with a chaotic family and life, trying to kind of just get her life on track and achieve her dreams. And all of the women in it are all trying to do the same, doggedly pursue their dreams while kind of dealing with the day-to-day chaos of their lives.
Yeah, I love
and
it.
And it's funny.
It's an absolute joy. It glows off of the screen as well. It looks beautiful and, it's constantly entertaining and challenging kind of ideas and perceptions. So what have been your influences on when making Alma? As I said, I think the BBC have been amazing in recent years with, as mentioned, This Country, People Just Do Nothing, Man Like Mobeen, but Channel 4 as well with things like Chewing Gum and all sorts of others where they're trusting a singular voice. They're trusting a creator to go, look, I'm going to be in this, I'm going to write it, I'm going to create this, but just trust me. And new voices as well, new in the worlds of TV. So were there any people or shows that were influencing you along the way? And was it, you know, did you feel the pressure of going, right, they've given me a lot of faith here?
I felt really lucky, and that's how I wanted it, because I'd written the first script in 2014. Yeah. And I was just so clear on the vision of it. I wanted it to be bright. I wanted the music to have a lot of Riot Girl punk in it, you know, and like Martha Wainwright. And, you know, I put all the there's loads of the songs that are in the show are what I scripted in. So I write in kind of a musical, filmic way, I think.
I love that. Everyone, all the script note advisors tell you not to write the music in or whatever. Every script I've written is rammed with the music of specific scenes, but that's how you envision it, right? When you're writing it, you're writing it as this amazing scene, and you have to have the complete scene in mind. It's like saying, don't put a description of the character in. So no, I need to know what I'm looking at. I need to know what I'm putting on page here.
And you're creating the mood, aren't you, and the emotion, and you're kind of, And that's interesting that it changes sometimes, doesn't it, in the edit. I mean, I've created scenes where I thought would be slightly more, you know, a moving scene or a bit more slower pace. You get in there and you think, actually, this needs a busy, loud, energetic track, and it changes the whole scene, you know, for the better.
Yeah.
So that's always kind of an interesting process, isn't it? But I feel just very lucky, really, that the BBC have just let me do my thing, you know, like influences, you know, Caroline Ahern, the royal family, Michaela Cole, Chewing Gum.
Yeah.
You know, all these women, Fleabag, you know, brilliant sitcom. You know, all these women that are showing other women at the forefront who are flawed as well. Flawed.
Back to Life is another
women.
One I didn't mention in that list of great things that the BBC have put their faith in, because I think that's amazing.
And Daisy's fabulous, isn't she?
She's fantastic. And again, she's real. She feels incredibly real. You sit down and talk to her and you're like, all right, you're just doing exactly what you want to do, aren't you? And they've seen that they should let you do that, you know?
Yeah. And unusual looking women as well, you know, all a bit unusual.
Yeah.
None of the women fit the mould in what you expected to see on your screen. Rose Matafeo's another one. She's just had a series and she's kind of... But Mae Martin, there's some really interesting voices
Feel
here,
Good's
isn't
amazing,
there?
Amazing, isn't it? And
oh, it's brilliant. Ashley B, you know,
I was just going to say, This Way Up is another one that's just...
Flawless
in how flawed it's allowed to be, if that makes any sense.
Definitely. You're following women that are not perfect or trying to present themselves in a certain way. They were just following them in an honest way, which I think is brilliant, isn't it?
Yeah. I love it. So, I mean, I'll start to wrap things up then by kind of asking what's ahead, because it's a big question for you, because in a period where your stand-up has, you know, probably had to go on hold because of a pandemic, because of all the changes there and the uncertainty over what's ahead. But in that period, your writing and acting has gone through the roof because you've got this show that's a BAFTA. Yeah. You've become a BAFTA award winner in this strange time. So what's ahead? Are you excited to get back to stand-up? Are you focused on writing? Are you focused on acting? What's the plan?
I think I'd probably try and get a second series and do that, you know. And then I'd like to do more scripted stuff. I'd like to see what's next, that it might not be so drawn from personal experience but might want to go in different directions. Me and Lem Sisse have been talking about setting up a production company together and the focus on that would be, again, giving, you know, people the platform to tell stories, you know, that are personal to them or that draw from their lives that we haven't seen on our screens, you know. Maybe more queer experience stories, because there's so many and they're all so different, you know. So I think we're both passionate about that. And also, it's a funny time, isn't it? Because I've no idea what the response will be to Alma or what will come out of it. So I'm kind of just hanging back, really, till the next chapter, till Monday.
Until you find out, It's a mad one.
Yeah.
Right there. Yeah, that must be a strange limbo to be in at this moment.
It's a funny limbo. That's why I'm so relieved. In a way, though, it's been very intense whirlwind that they were putting it on so quickly, because actually it just means I don't have to wait for months and think, oh, what's next, you know?
It's all going to happen and it's there. Well, to wrap things up, I realise we touched upon stories of care but didn't go into it much. So can you tell me a little bit about that? Because it sounds like an amazing project and thing to be doing.
Yes, I do like a 20-week writing course. We've got about 12 to 13 partners and we're Arts Council funding. We do a writing course with care experienced people, and eventually we develop a children's anthology full of short fictional fun stories that have a baseline of, you know, unique family setups and care experience. That book, this is our second one now, that book then gets given out to children in care all over the country. Alongside that, we offer sort of artistic mentoring and professional development training for the people that are participants, and that continues. So the first project we did was in 2015. That was a two-year project, and we're still mentoring those care experienced people now. And actually, a few of them are now employed by the organisation as company members and running the workshops and different things. So we have that strand. We have other strands. So we have a lead artist that we develop every couple of years that would kind of creates a solo show or creates a stand-up show and they go on tour. I'm wanting to do a new strand of Stories of Care. What I do, it's just a very comedy-focused strand. So I'm hoping to kind of develop new voices to tell those stories in comedy. And I think, for me, the power was all about going, not just having stories written about you where you are the subject of children's fiction or the subject of television, but actually you're the one telling the stories. You're the one who owns the story. You're the one who leads the story, I felt, for me, was really important, and we're the ones who run the organisation. So having previous participants now running it with me, that's very empowering, because actually they know more about what it was like to be a participant than I do. So when they're running these workshops, you know, they've got a better sort of handle on it than I would have had, you know. It feels a positive thing.
I love it. Having seen what you've already achieved and how you've gone about it, every time in this conversation that you've said something like, I'd quite like to do this or I'd quite like to go there, I don't have a doubt in my mind that you're going to very much achieve all of those things. And I'm excited to see all that is ahead. So thank you for taking the time.
Thank you for a lovely interview. It's been fabulous. Thank you very much.
No problem. I'm going to press stop there.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Sophie Willan. I hope you enjoyed that. Get on iPlayer. Bring Alma's Not Normal up. 6 episodes, under 30 minutes an episode. You'll be done in 3 hours. You'll feel all the better for it. Big love to Sophie. Big love to you lot for listening. Big love to everyone who's been raving about the Loki episode, the Sam Sproul episode from last week. I'll be back next week with more goodness. But until then, this has been episode 409 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the wonderful Sophie Willan. Stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.